This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
We get the best start to the day because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
What a big night for James Wood last night. 3-for-4, 2 homers, 5 RBIs. The Nats beat the Dodgers 8-2. They've won 4 games in a row, and 2 of them have been against the Dodgers. They're looking for their first sweep of the Dodgers in a 3-game series since 2008. Joining us right now is our good friend Mark Zuckerman from Masson. He covers the team for Masson. You can follow Mark and all of his work on X on Twitter, at Mark Zuckerman. You can go to MassonSports.com as well. Look, with the way they started the first 6 or 7 games, and I understand, you know, this is a long season. We've got a lot of games left. But it looked like, uh-oh, this is going to get ugly and get ugly early. What's happened here in the last 4 games?
I think what's happened, Kevin, is they're hitting. They're really hitting. And in that first week of the season, they just weren't doing that. I'm a little surprised only because of who the competition is.
Right.
You know, they're 1-6, and they've got a homestand here with the Diamondbacks, who won, you know, went to the World Series 2 years ago, and then the Dodgers obviously won the World Series last year. And I'm thinking they just have to find a way to survive this week, and then maybe things start to get better as the schedule eases up. They are hitting. They're hitting early. They're hitting home runs. And what that's allowing Davey Martinez to do is to actually use his better relievers for the most part. And I know the bullpen was a problem that first week, but when you have a lead, you can actually use Finnegan and Ferrer and Lopez, and it's just made these games a lot more comfortable, I think, for them.
Yeah, the Nats have 15 home runs now in their first 11 games. That's the fourth most in the National League. And, you know, we didn't talk that much before the season. I know a lot of people felt like the only chance they had to be, you know, around 500, and maybe when you get to, you know, mid to late August, you've still got an outside shot at a wild card, was to definitely hit better, but starting pitching would be crucial. I don't know that anybody was expecting them to hit for this kind of power this early. So that is the big surprise. Can it continue?
Yeah, I think it can, because they did make it a priority this winter. And I know, you know, you didn't look at the lineup on paper and say, oh, wow, this is a fearsome lineup. But all the additions they made were made with the idea of trying to add more home run power to the mix. Nathaniel Lowe, who's been very good for them so far. Josh Bell, who actually hasn't been that great for them so far. But, you know, the idea is that he is going to hit for power for them. And then really what it boiled down to were the young guys who, you know, have home run potential, now being in the lineup full-time, and that's James Wood. Dylan Cruz, who has not hit yet, but I think, that, again, the belief is that he will. But Keibert Ruiz, Luis Garcia, C.J. Abrams, they actually had a lot of power potential on this team. Now, they may not rank in the top 5 in the league all year long. That's probably too much to ask. But all they needed to be is just an average power team, and I think it changes the lineup tremendously, and I think you're already seeing that.
So just give me, you know, your thoughts on James Wood so far. Wood and Cruz obviously were the focus of a lot of fans and a lot of baseball people. What kind of seasons would they have? Cruz, really slow start, 2-for-4 last night. But let's start with Wood. What's he been so far, and what do you think that can equal by the time we get to the end of September?
Well, he's been exactly what they were hoping he would be, and really what we saw the second half of last season after he was called up. The opposite field power is special. There just aren't that many guys who can hit a ball the way that he did the first inning last night and in the seventh inning the night before that. It is, I'm not comparing him as a full hitter and player to him, but from the opposite field power standpoint, it's very Juan Soto-esque to be able to drive a ball as well to left center field as he can to right center field. And really, the majority of his homers do go to the opposite field. So he's doing that. He's still, showing enough patience. He drew a bases-loaded walk last night. He's bounced around the lineup a little bit. I think the idea all along was that he'd be two or three, and because he was slumping a little bit that first week, David Martinez moved him down. But what he's done the last couple of days shows you that that's not really going to last for long. He absolutely has 30 to 40 homer potential, as well as drawing a lot of walks with a high on-base percentage and, you know, being a superstar player. And it's been so encouraging to see that he's doing this already this early in his career, because you never know for sure. And, you know, with Cruz, it hasn't happened right away. It doesn't mean that it won't, but I think Cruz is more normal in terms of traditional development of a player than Wood, who's really come on gangbusters here early on.
Let me just ask you about a situation on Monday night in the 6-4 win over the Dodgers, when Davey made the decision to pull Wood defensively in the top of the ninth with the Dodgers, heart of the order coming up. I think Ohtani and Betts were both scheduled to hit there. Wood was, I think, due up either second or third in the bottom of the ninth had they gotten there. I talked to Tommy about this yesterday. He seemed oblivious to it. Was that a tough call? Was that something that was discussed among you guys or not?
Yeah, it absolutely was. And in part because a couple nights earlier, they're in the exact same situation. It was up by a run or two going to ninth. And he left James in. And in part, Dave even said, just in case his spot came up, they blew the lead. So here they are in the exact same situation, maybe two nights later, and he did go for the defense by bringing in Jacob Young. And what he said was essentially, in that game, you're asking Kyle Finnegan, pitching for the third straight day, to give you a five-out save against some of the best hitters in the world. And I think inherently what he's saying in there is, I'm more worried about fly balls to the outfield than I want my best defense out there, and I will take the chance that they don't come back and that I don't miss having Wood batting second for me in the bottom of the ninth, because hopefully we're not going to get to that point. It was a close call. It's a tough call. Now, you saw he DH last night. The one thing about James so far that you have to acknowledge is that defensively, he hasn't been all that impressive. Now, in the minors, he had an excellent defensive reputation. He played center field a lot. Now, so far in the majors, they have him in left field because they have Jacob Young, and because Dylan Cruz is also really good. But while he's gotten a little better, I wouldn't say he still looks all that comfortable in left field. So I will be interested as we move forward, does this become a regular thing, and are they acknowledging, even at age 22, that he's really an offensive player and defense is not going to be his forte? I think there's still hope that he can get better at it, but especially if they're winning games and they're playing important games the rest of the season, that may become something to keep an eye on. Do they pull him for defense late?
I mean, the Dodgers did get to two on and two out with Betts up, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, they took it right down to the wire there, and it absolutely, I mean, they're, you know, one hit away from maybe tying the game, and now you're going to be looking at Jacob Young batting second in the bottom line instead of James Wood. So it could have backfired, absolutely. It was interesting how two nights, they don't make the move, and then this one they do, and how they're going to do that moving forward.
Talk about Dylan Cruz's struggles here early in the season. Really nice night last night, and I think it's two out of the last three games he's gone 2-for-4. It's a long season. People go through these stretches, but just give me a minute on Dylan Cruz so far.
Well, the first week really struggled. I mean, he struck out 8 straight times at one point, and yeah, I think 5 of them were on 3 pitches. So he was swinging at everything, and we didn't see a lot of him last season when he was called up, but what we did see is that he struggled with breaking balls and struggled with chasing breaking balls out of the zone. So the league doesn't take long. They're smart. They know how to find create a book on him. And so he was getting a steady diet of fastballs up and in and then breaking balls down and away, and he was not showing that he could lay off them. He got a day off in, I think it was in Toronto last week. He's been down in the lineup trying to take pressure off him. And then since then, he started to show some signs here. He hit a couple of balls really hard, even though they were out. They were like 100, 110 miles an hour off the bat. That's a good sign. And now, just the last few days, you're starting to see the hits fall. And he's been much more, selective, I think, at the plate, swinging at the right pitches, and just kind of hitting singles up the middle. It's not for power yet, but you got to start somewhere, and I think they believe this is the start of it. Again, he was in college barely a year ago, and it does take some time. And it's what James Wood's doing is not the norm. I think what Dylan Chris is doing is a little more normal. You hope to see that development over the course of the season.
How about K-Bear Ruiz's start?
That's been outstanding. I mean, maybe the most pleasant development so far for this team, because Ruiz had an awful 2024, and he's the first to admit it, both offensively and defensively. And he dug himself into such a hole in April and May that it just felt like he was trying to climb out of it the entire year. And even though he was better in the second half, it still doesn't really show up on the stat line at all. So he came into this season knowing he needed to get off to a good start, and he's done exactly that. I think it's 9 out of 10 games with a hit. He's got 9 RBI already, playing a lot. I believe he's going to be in the lineup again today, which would mean 11 out of 12 games he started behind the plate, which is kind of insane, but they've had off days, so that helps mitigate that a little bit. Psychologically, it's been huge for him. He needed this. I think the team needs to see this just to erase any doubts or questions that anybody has. Like, is he really the long-term catcher or not?
The Nats have won 4 in a row. They're 5-6, and they had a very difficult schedule to start. Mark Zuckerman from Masson, our good friend, is joining us on the show. The Nats send Jake Irvin out there this afternoon in the series closer against the Dodgers. Only chance to see Shohei Ohtani here in D.C. this year. Starting pitching was, I think for a lot of you guys, the area in which you said if they get it, beyond Gore, and they have a really good starting pitching rotation, they got a chance to win, they have a chance to win 81 and go 500. What through 11 games has struck you about their starting pitching rotation?
They've really been solid. There hasn't been one truly bad start yet. There have been a couple that aren't anything special, 3 or 4 runs in 5 innings, but nobody's had a blow-up start yet. Mackenzie Gore has been outstanding in 2 out of his 3. I mean, he is pitching like an ace is supposed to pitch, and that's a great thing to see. Mitchell Parker has been sort of a stopper. For a while there, he had the only 2 wins of the year, and giving them length with, I think, at least 6 innings in each of his starts. The Michael Soroka injury, you're thinking at first, oh, this could be a problem, because they really didn't have the pitching depth, especially with DJ Herz on the IL. And Shinosuke Ogasawara, the Japanese pitcher they signed, is at AAA, and clearly what we saw in spring training has got a ways to go before he shows he's big league ready. So all of a sudden you're worried about the depth, but then what happened last night? Brad Lord in, it's a bullpen game, but they're going to ultimately make him a starter. Gives you 3 scoreless innings against the Dodgers, and all of a sudden you're feeling a lot better about the depth that they may have now. So it's been very encouraging. While maybe the rotation hasn't been great outside of Gore, what they have done is give them a much
everything. Mark's starting to break up there a little bit. We'll try. We'll get one more in here, and we appreciate the time. Give me just something else. Through 11 games, that's been a storyline, either positive or negative, for people who haven't been, following each game pitch by pitch.
I think the bullpen, that was the number one concern coming in. We know they didn't spend a lot of money there. They waited it out with Finnegan and ultimately brought him back on a lesser deal. And you're just wondering, is this going to work with what they have? And those first several days of the season, it was ugly. It was really ugly. But it started to stabilize. And what you saw from Finnegan the other night, 3 straight days, no, he may not be the most dominant lights-out closer in the sport, but he's really durable, and he really takes pride in being available for them for something like that.
Mark, actually, one last one. Could a sweep over the Dodgers in early April, could it mean something? Like, is it something that, you might look back if they end up being in a wild card race in, mid to late August? You look back and say, we were reeling basically going into that stretch, and that kind of gave us some confidence or something. Does any of this mean anything to the largesse of a 162-game season?
Well, it's probably too early to say, like, this is where it all started, because it's basically the start of the season anyways. But
yeah.
What I think this week has done is, if there was anybody in that clubhouse that was starting to get worried and think, maybe we're not that good, maybe we're not really ready yet, just the way they've played against the Diamondbacks and Dodgers in particular has got to be a boost of confidence. And to be able to close out games late, I do think that matters. As the season goes on and maybe they are playing big, important games later on this summer, you can look back on, like, that game Monday night that was a really tense, tight game against a great team, and that they pulled it off. I think that matters. I think you now have that experience and say, okay, we've been here before, we can do this. I think that kind of stuff matters. I don't think you can necessarily say, oh, well, hey, remember that series against the Dodgers? That's when it all started for them. But just the experience of playing a young team like this, I do think that matters.
Thanks for this. Appreciate it, and we'll talk soon. I think we got just as much as we could out of Mark as he was on his phone driving. Really interesting start. I mean, a sweep over the Dodgers, considering they started the season, I think, 9-0. Was it 9-0 that they started? 8-0, something like that. They won a lot of games to start the season, and they have lost two straight to the Nationals. And James Wood asserting himself here early. He's got four home runs in the first 11 games of the season. I think his over-under on home runs this year was like 25.5. I think I saw something like that. So he is ahead of that pace. He's on pace for an over, if anybody decided to take that. Some NFL scheduling stuff to talk about next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com. Some NFL news from last week's league meetings that we didn't, you know, focus on a lot. One thing we did, but there's more information on. One thing we did not, and I'm going to start with that. The likelihood of the NFL moving to an 18-game regular season seems to be, as Jonathan Jones wrote at CBS Sports, a fait accompli. Like, that's essentially the way the owners have talked about the 18th game. It's over. It's going to happen. It has to be collectively bargained with the NFL Players Association, but they're apparently, in the conversations that reporters had with various owners last week, there seems to be no concern that this will take place. Several sources indicated to Jonathan Jones at CBS Sports that it would be instituted at the earliest, and potentially, and I've read in multiple spots, the 2027 regular season. So that would mean we've got two more regular seasons of 17 games, and then in 2028 we would get an 18-game schedule. Part of the clues for the 2027 season being the season that they institute an 18-game schedule is that Super Bowl, the Super Bowl in 2028, the 2027 season, is scheduled for Atlanta. There's no date for that Super Bowl. Typically, when you are three or four Super Bowl future sites out ahead, the dates are attached. Like, next year's Super Bowl is in Santa Clara, the 49ers' home, February 8th, 2026. A year later, it's at SoFi in L.A., in Inglewood, February 14th, 2027. That would be, by the way, a very late Super Bowl. In fact, February 14th. I'd have to look that up, but that would be about as late as I think the Super Bowl could take place in the current 17-game one-bye format. It probably means that Labor Day was super late that year. That's my guess. But there's no date attached to the Super Bowl for the 2027 season, the 2028 Super Bowl in Atlanta. Now, how would it play out, an 18-game schedule? We've talked about this a lot over the years. By the way, my position is really simple. I think they will, and I'm for it. I, right now, can't envision a scenario in which it was too much football for me. I love football season. I love the rhythm of football season. I love the rhythm of that time of year. I love the scheduled nature of it. I think for a lot of people, even just casual sports fans, there's something comforting about football being on TV in the fall and in the winter. But how would it play out? Well, it would be a longer season. Right now, we've got an 18-week regular season, 17 games, one bye week. When, and I say when, not if, when they go to an 18-game season, and let's just say it's 2027, it will be a 20-week regular season with two bye weeks per team. We can talk about, you know, what this could lead to. I've heard people say, well, you're going to get, you know, load management with teams. No, you're not. You're not sitting a quarterback, you know, in a meaningful, you know, NFL regular season game. That's not going to happen. You know, I think there is discussion about increasing the size of rosters potentially. That would be part of the union and the league negotiations over an 18-game schedule. But anyway, you would get 20 weeks, 18 games, two bye weeks per team. For this season to have its Super Bowl played on President's Day weekend, which would be the goal every year, because the Super Bowl on a Sunday and a national holiday, everybody gets to stay home the day after the Super Bowl on that Monday, would be the goal. That means the season would have to begin on Labor Day weekend with 20 weeks and two bye weeks to get a President's Day weekend Super Bowl. You'd have to actually start the season Labor Day weekend. That would not be unprecedented. When the league first went from 14 to 16 games in 1978, for several years they opened up the season on Labor Day weekend. And then they realized that the Labor Day weekend games were not generating the television ratings that they thought a week one of the NFL season should generate. So they pushed it back, and hence pushed back the season with 16 games. You know, there was a season, a test season in the early 90s of two bye weeks. I think it was just one season. But anyway, Labor Day weekend, 20 weeks, two byes, Super Bowl Sunday comes, President's Day weekend. That Labor Day weekend has been really for many, many years now a college football weekend. But the NFL has basically imposed itself on a lot of things. You know, Christmas Day, sorry NBA. Black Friday, sorry college football. And even that first Friday of the season on opening day weekend, which typically is a massive high school football night. Sorry, we're playing an NFL game in Brazil. Now, there is still, per you know, the laws that were set up back in the 60s with television and football and the rights that they have, there is still an inability for football to play on Saturdays or Friday nights during the core of college football and high school football season. They got a waiver, I think, for the Friday night Brazil game because it's pre-Labor Day. But you'll see, that's why you don't see Saturday NFL games until after the college regular season ends. But we're going to get 18 games, guys. We're going to get that, and I think we're going to get it in 2027. And I, for one, am for it. You know, I don't think that things like load management, I think you have to increase the roster sizes. I don't know what they increase to, but I think part of the negotiations are to increase roster sizes. The idea of an extra game creating a load management scenario for quarterbacks or for key players with the extra bye week to me is absurd. You're just not going to see that. These aren't 82-game schedules where a lot of the games, really, relatively speaking, don't matter. Now, the other thing that came out of the league meetings was something we did talk about last week, and that is the playoff seeding and the playoff format, which, by the way, could get changed for the upcoming season. They tabled it, It's going to be re-examined next month in the next league meetings, but there are essentially three possibilities. Number one is that the Lions' proposal of seeding based on record after you've got the seven teams in each conference qualified, that is something that apparently the commissioner was upset wasn't approved right away. Goodell really likes it. He said that there was a report that he was visibly irritated that more teams weren't on board with that possible change. The Steelers in particular are among the teams that don't want anything to change. But there are three possibilities. One is the four division winners and the next three best records, wild card teams, all qualify for the playoffs. So that does not impact the integrity of the division system. But once you have the seven qualified teams, you get seeded based on record. So last year, as an example, Washington would have been the four seed and would have hosted a first-round game against the Packers, who would have been the five seed. Last year, if you recall, Tampa had a 10-7 record, and the Rams had a 10-7 record, but as division winners got a home game. They were both seeded ahead of Washington, Minnesota, and Green Bay, all of whom had better records than Tampa and the Rams. So that's one scenario, and that's the one apparently the commissioner wants. The other is a modified version of that, where you don't change the current structure unless division winners would not get to host a playoff game if they finished with a losing record. So you'd have the seven qualified teams, four division winners, and three wild cards. But to host a game as a division winner, you'd have to have, you could not have a losing record. You know, the last teams to do that were Tampa in 2022, Washington in 2020, the Panthers in 2014, and the Seahawks back in 2010. So you couldn't get an 8-9 or a 7-10 team hosting. You'd have to finish with a winning record to host a game. So that's a modified version. And the last option that they'll consider is not changing anything. So seeding 1-7. Based on records after you qualify all seven teams, not ruining the division integrity, four division winners, they all get in. A division winner could go 5-12 or 6-11 and still qualify, but they wouldn't get to host a game. The modified would be the same system as we have today with one exception. If a team wins a division with a losing record, they don't get to host a game. And then the last one is to keep it the same. I don't know what's going to happen in May. The votes would have been super close, according to the reports, for the total seating change. The first proposal, the commissioner is all for that. I'm for that. I'm for, let's see the seating based on record. By the way, you would create more meaningful games at the end of the year if teams were playing for seating as well as playoff qualification. When will we get news on the RFK site for a new stadium? Eric Flack from WUSA Channel 9 will join us next. Seems like we haven't heard anything on the stadium for a while. Like, kind of thought that when we got the, 2 a.m., 11th hour save, that we might, with the new Congress taking shape in mid-January, that we would have had something resolved by now. Eric Flack covers the stadium story and has better than anybody. He joins us right now, of course, Eric, from WUSA TV9. So am I right? Doesn't it seem like this story is dragged on? And if so, why and what's going on?
Well, it was so much excitement, and then it just all went dead because once DC got the land, everybody kind of forgot about the fact that then, the team in the city had to hammer out a deal. I think a lot is going on behind the scenes that is not in the public eye right now. I think there are a lot, what I'm hearing is that there are a lot of discussions ongoing and pretty intensive between the team and the mayor's office to, in fact, figure out what the parameters of a potential stadium deal to bring the Commanders back to D.C. are going to be. But when Congress sort of threatened and then in actuality did in take away a bunch of money, about $1 billion from D.C. government, that threw everything into a tailspin because all of a sudden D.C. government was facing a catastrophic budget deficit, budget crisis. Now, we now know that there's a bill to kind of replace that funding and kind of set the city back to where it was financially, which I've been told is going to allow the city to move forward with the stadium agreement as they planned. But really, until Congress officially passes that legislation to kind of put DC's budget back where it was and always, you know, before, really nothing can be announced officially. So I think they're kind of, I think the negotiations continue behind the scenes. I think I've been told that they're very close to you know, reaching and some sort of an agreement. But really, they can't move forward with anything. Nothing can be official until, you know, the Congress, you know, fixes D.C.'s budget. And only then can they kind of move forward with the stadium stuff.
I want to make sure I'm clear on something. The budget conversation, the budget things that you just talked about, that's different than control of the land. The city has control of the land, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. The city has control of the land to build a stadium, a Ferris wheel.
To do whatever they want.
Zoo, whatever they want.
Yeah.
That is, and the language that has been signed by Congress to give the city back the land said it can do a multitude of things, including building a stadium there. But
weren't
DC has
you and everybody else, and I even thought it was kind of intuitive. Didn't we all think that once they got control of the land, that the parameters of a deal between the city and the team had been discussed,
yes,
had gotten close to the, yes, finish line? It didn't mean that the team was okay with it. It didn't mean that it would pass in the on the council, but that,
yes,
the framework of a deal was in place as long,
yes,
as they got the land.
Yes, yes. And I don't know. I mean, the mayor told me on the record in front of a camera that the negotiations were going on before they got the land back. So,
right,
we know for sure that talks were happening. I mean, the mayor was in the box with Josh Harris and the Commanders and all the people, like, multiple times. So we know the discussions were ongoing. How substantial those discussions were, I think, remains unclear. And I think what I understand is that there was much more to do post land return to,
got
DC
it.
And in fact, there was not a, you know, blanket contract that just needed "we have the land back" to be filled in on line number 6 to move forward. That they did in fact have to kind of hammer out details and who would pay for what and how it would be done. But I've been told that a lot of progress has been made on that. And, you know, but until the budget is kind of official, I think it would be irresponsible, the belief is, to kind of announce anything, even if they have parameters in place. And again, to be clear, I don't think a deal has been officially struck behind the scenes that when Congress, if when as expected Congress fixes this budget thing, that, you know, but that the deal is already signed. I think it could be very quickly that after that, you know, budget announcement is made, that we hear about, you know, a Commander's stadium deal with the district.
So just thinking about it, Eric, chronologically, and just, you know, tell me where I've missed on this. So we've got this new wrinkle, which is restoring the DC budget. So let's just assume that happens. Then it's about coming to an agreement with the city over the parameters of a deal. You know, how much the city's going to pay for, what the stadium's going to look like, what the surrounding area, who does what, infrastructure-wise, et cetera. By the way, for the team's sake, to compare side-by-side with whatever the Maryland offer is. Then it goes to the city council, where they have to get 7 votes out of the 13 council members before it ends up being finalized, and then we, you know, have a ribbon cutting ceremony to, you know, start construction on something at some point. Is that chronologically the next few steps before we get to, okay, it's going to go there at RFK?
That's all correct. And I think while it is understood that the mayor's office is dealing and negotiating with the commanders independently of any other voices on DC council, because the mayor has always sort of, you know, negotiated in that way and is very independent and cuts her own deals, that it is also understood that the people who the commanders have working on this project understand how the sausage is made. And that it wasn't too long ago that an owner of a basketball team and a hockey team in this city cut a deal with the governor in Virginia and thought he had a new arena in Northern Virginia, but forgot he had to have the approval of the entire Virginia legislature. You know, the commanders aren't gonna make that mistake. Are certainly gonna do everything they can to not make that mistake. So they have, and I've reported in the past, they are having some like parallel discussions with council members. Here's what we're talking about to make sure that whatever they ultimately negotiate with the mayor and agree to with the mayor is ultimately going to get through DC council. It doesn't make any sense to cut some deal with the mayor.
It's wasting time.
That's never going to get through DC council. So they kind of have to walk and chew gum at the same time. And I think they're doing that.
Well, do you feel like the team that Josh Harris and his group have some comfort that whatever they discussed would get passed by the council?
I think that they are laser focused on getting the stadium built in DC. I think that's priority one, job one. I think they have really smart people who understand the politics, and I think they understand that it's a two-part process. So it's a long way of saying, yeah, I think that they, to the extent that they are getting close to some sort of an agreement with the mayor, if this DC budget thing with Congress gets worked out, I don't think they would ever try and sign some deal and have some press conference for a deal that was ultimately not going to get through DC council. So I think they probably do have some comfortability that they're close enough, I mean, the ballpark, to use a pun, with both sides.
At Eric Flack TV, Eric's joining us right now from WUSA Channel 9. You know, one of the things that I think, just from afar, and maybe I'm off on this, the football team's showing some patience here, because they do have a timeline, and this restoring the DC budget and getting, you know, a government to move quickly, they want to get a shovel into the ground sooner rather than later. So just update me on whether or not there's, you know, some frustration on the process here maybe having been slowed down a bit by this DC budget issue.
Well, I think so. But if you think holistically about how this has gone, I mean, how many twists and turns and roadblocks have there been that they've overcome? I mean, reaching an agreement to get to the to get the land back, only to have it blown up in the middle of the final days of Congress, only to have this 11th hour, 2 a.m., you know, Hail Mary passage of the land deal. So, yeah, I mean, I think they would always like it to move quicker. I mean, we all want to have the ribbon-cutting ceremony. Everybody wants the team back in D.C., which, as we know, is the majority of people. That's not opinion. That's fact. We all want it to the ribbon-cutting ceremony. But I do think they know that they have this process, which dates back to Dan Snyder, of getting the team back to RFK, to the RFK site, has never been closer. And all these roadblocks that come up have to be almost expected, par for the course, you know, so to speak, with the way this process has gone. But, you know, it is in the, it is very likely understood and expected that the Congress is going to fix, put back this budget thing, restore DC's budget. They are, you know, continuing to make progress with DC. And I think that, you know, as many roadblocks and frustrations have as there have been, including the fact that the mayor, like, you know, by DC code is supposed to have the budget, you know, presented a week ago, but obviously can't do that because of everything that's going on in Congress, and the chief financial officer can't even approve it because of everything being in flux. But even with things getting delayed, if in fact late April, early May, you know, you get a deal, you get a budget deal, DC's budget is back where it is, then you get a stadium deal, you're still on track to potentially get DC Council to approve it by this summer, which is all, which has always been the timeline. DC Council always approves these things in the summer. They approved Nats Park in the summer. This always happens kind of in that window. So the time window, despite all the obstacles, is actually still about where it needs to be.
So what does that mean? If everything's kind of on, comes together and City Council passes it this summer, when does the stadium open?
I think 2030. I think that's what they're saying, 2030. Maybe fall 2030, 2031 season. So it would be like September. It would be that like fall opening weekend of 2030 into 2031, which I think is entire, which I think, you know, we're in 2025 right now. So that gives them a good amount of time. I mean, that's plenty of time to build a stadium, to have it done, by, you know, 2030, which I think was always the expected timeline. The mayor came out like after they got the, she was kind of riding on the high of getting the land back and said, I think we could do it in 2 or 3 years. I don't know anybody who really believes that's possible with all the things that have to be done. I mean, there's still a stadium there, for God's sakes. You know, I mean, it's not like empty land. So
when will that be raised?
I think it was supposed to be last year, but
yeah,
they had
right.
so many environmental issues. I think they're supposed to be taking it down piece by piece, section by section, later on this year. I've been told inside is all, it's a shell now. There's nothing left inside. Literally, it's just the shell of the stadium that's remaining. I think they want to have some, you know, ceremonies and stuff to mark right. it's and it would make sense that might be in conjunction, wouldn't it, with a stadium announcement. I mean, it would make sense that, you know, they announce, you know, the announcement of the new stadium comes as they announce tearing down, plans to tear down and remember the old stadium. Yeah.
Last one, Eric, and appreciate the time and the update. So do we know definitively what the stadium will look like? Capacity, domed, retractable roof? What do we know about that?
Here's what I know. 65,000 is the cutoff for a Super Bowl. So it's going to be around 65,000, between 65,000 and 70,000. They don't want – these stadiums aren't that huge anymore. Like Jerry Jones and Allegiant, you know, aside. So over 65, but not too huge. It will have a dome. Retractable is not the trend anymore. It's just too expensive and not necessary. Translucent domes are what's being built now, to where it's not a dome that gets retracted, but you still have that feeling that you're outside because you see the sky. And then based on reporting, I've done no tailgating. Or extremely, yeah. Because there's no parking, there's not going to be the parking lot space. That's the right. One thing that FedEx has going for it, is just a sea of parking lots for tailgating. They won't have that.
We went through that conversation and debate, you know, a month or so ago. Yep. And that is the trend too, especially with downtown stadiums. Thank you so much, Eric. Appreciate the update. Yeah. Hope you're well.
Anytime, man.
Eric Flack. Eric Flack TV on X on Twitter. Steve Sands from Augusta next.